I want to start today with a question that sounds incredibly stupid. It is so simple, you are probably going to roll your eyes at me. You ready?
Okay, I am braced for impact. Lay it on me.
How do you know for an absolute fact that the sun will rise tomorrow morning?
Right. That is a deceptively simple question. And the simple answer, I mean, the one everyone gives, is just because it rose this morning and the morning before that. And, you know, every morning for the last 4.5 billion years.
Exactly. It's obvious. It's literally the most reliable thing in human experience. But today, we are going to take that obvious fact, put it under a microscope, and basically watch it completely fall apart.
We are indeed. Today, we are deep diving into a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the philosophy of David Hume. The lecture is specifically titled, Do We Know What's Real? And honestly, by the end of this deep dive, you might not be so sure of the answer.
But mission for this deep dive is pretty wild. We're going to dismantle your confidence in logic, literally strip it away and replace it with something that feels a lot less sturdy. We're going to replace knowing with feeling and habit.
It sounds unsettling, doesn't it? But that is David Hume for you. He's often called the ultimate skeptic. But it's really important to clarify right at the top here, Hume isn't saying reality doesn't exist. He's not saying the sun won't rise.
Right.
He's saying that our way of knowing it will rise is much, much shakier than we like to admit.
He's basically telling us we're running on autopilot and calling it intelligence.
In a way, yes. He's peeling back the hood of human reason and showing us that the engine isn't made of gears and logic at all. It's made of instinct.
So we've got a roadmap for today. We're going to start by looking at the problem of cause and effect. That's the big one. Then we'll look at the solution Hume proposes, which is purely psychological. And finally, we're going to apply this whole framework to the big three, the self, miracles, and God.
It's a heavy list, but it all starts with how we think, or, well, how we think we think.
Okay, let's unpack this. Dr. Holmes breaks down Hume's view of human inquiry into two very specific buckets. If we want to know anything, it has to fit in one of these two boxes.
Right. Hume says everything we investigate falls into one of two categories. First, you have what he calls relations of ideas. These are analytic judgments. Think mathematics, logic, A equals A.
So basic stuff, 2 + 2 = 4. A bachelor is an unmarried man.
Exactly. It's safe. It's always true. But, and here's the catch, it doesn't actually tell you anything about the physical world. It's a tautology. It's true by definition.
Wait, a tautology?
Yeah, it means the predicate is contained in the subject. Like, if I say all triangles have three sides, I haven't told you if any triangles actually exist out there in the universe. I've just told you about the definition of the word triangle. It's just ideas in your head. It's safe, but it's totally disconnected from reality.
Okay, so math is safe and certain, but disconnected. What's the second bucket?
The second bucket is matters of fact. These are things that actually exist in the real world. The sun, the chair you're sitting in, the fire in the fireplace.
And this is where the trouble starts.
This is exactly where the trouble starts. Because Hume asks, how do we know matter of fact? We can't use logic because logic is just definitions. So if you see a fire, how do you know it's going to burn you?
Well, because fire causes heat, cause and effect. I see the fire, I expect the heat.
Precisely. We rely entirely on cause and effect to navigate the world. We argue from the experience, the effect, back to the cause. But Hume drops a massive bomb here. He says, look closely at your experience. Look really closely. Do you ever actually see the cause?
See, this was the aha moment for me in the source material. What do you mean? If I watch a billiard ball hit another one, I see the first one cause the second one to move.
Do you, or do you just see event A, ball one moves, and then event B, ball two moves? You see the conjunction of those two events. But do you see the power? Do you actually see the force or the energy transferring from one ball to the other?
Well, no. I just see the sequence.
That is the whole crux of it. We never experience causal power. We only experience what Hume calls constant conjunction, uniformity. We see things happening in a sequence over and over, and we assume there is a connection, but we never actually see the connection itself.
That is maddening. You're saying I'm just assuming the connection exists because I've seen it happen a lot.
Yes. And if you try to logically prove that the connection exists, you end up in a circular argument. You might say, well, the sun has risen every day in the past, so it must rise tomorrow. But you're using past experience to prove that the future will look like the past.
Which I only know because of past experience.
Exactly. You're using experience to prove experience. It's a loop. Logically, you cannot bridge the gap between it happened yesterday and it will happen tomorrow. There is no logical contradiction in saying the sun will not rise tomorrow. It's not like saying 2 + 2 = 5. It's perfectly possible.
So this leads to total skepticism. I mean, if we can't prove cause and effect, we essentially know nothing beyond this exact second of sensory experience.
If you stick strictly to logic, yes. We are trapped in the present moment, unable to predict anything. Logic cannot get you from this bread nourished me yesterday to this bread will nourish me today.
Wait a minute. We do predict things. I know my car will start. I know the floor will hold me up. I know that if I don't eat lunch, I'm going to get hangry. If logic fails us, how are we functioning?
That brings us to section 2, the solution. And the solution is that we aren't logical creatures at all. We are creatures of habit.
Custom and habit.
Right. Since reason fails to ground our beliefs, nature steps in. Hume says we operate on psychological habit or custom. The repeated occurrence, the sun rising every day, conditions our minds. It creates a groove.
So it's like Pavlov's dog.
Very similar. We are conditioned to expect the result. Dr. Holmes contrasts this with Joseph Butler, another thinker of that time. Butler said probability is the guide of life. He thought we were sitting there calculating the odds, like rational gamblers. Hume disagrees completely. He says we don't calculate, we feel.
It's gut check.
It is. Hume defines belief not as a rational decision, but as a forceful and steady impression.
I love the example Dr. Holmes cited from the text here. The fairy giraffe.
Yes, the fairy giraffe with butterfly wings.
It's such a great image. Hume says, imagine a fairy giraffe on your windowsill right now. Now look at me sitting in this chair. You can imagine the giraffe vividly. You can see the wings, the spots, everything. But there's a difference between that imagination and the belief that I'm actually here.
And that difference isn't about reality in a philosophical sense. It's about the vivacity and the force of the impression. The belief that I am here hits you harder. It's forceful and steady. The giraffe is fleeting. That feeling, that oomph, is what we call truth.
That is wild. He's taking Plato's divided line. You know, that famous ladder of knowledge where you climb up from shadows to pure reason. And he's basically just chopping off the top half.
He is. He's saying there is no intuitive knowledge or demonstrative knowledge of the physical world. There's just perceptual belief and fiction. And the only difference between them is how hard they hit your brain.
So we're navigating the world based on vibes, forceful and steady vibes.
Essentially, yes, we feel the truth. We don't deduce it.
Okay, if we're running on feelings and habit, what does that mean for free will? Because I feel like I'm making choices. I chose to wear this shirt. I chose to record this deep dive today.
Ah, the question of liberty versus necessity. This is where Hume gets really interesting and, frankly, a bit provocative.
Dr. Holmes brought up this anecdote about deciding what to have for dinner or what to think about.
Right. You're sitting there thinking, what should I eat? You feel this impression of starting a thought train. You feel like you are the cause. But Hume says that feeling in the pit of your stomach, that sense of agency, is just another impression. It's just another feeling.
But I'm deciding. I can change my mind right now.
Are you? Or are you just experiencing a constant conjunction of feelings followed by actions? Hume points out that human behavior is actually incredibly regular. He mentions that adolescents act like adolescents. People generally act like people. We are just as predictable as the tides.
That's a little insulting, but probably true. Marketers certainly seem to think so.
Exactly. He argues the debate between free will and determinism is just semantic. We believe we are free only because we don't feel the gears turning. We don't feel the cause. But when we look at other people, we believe in determinism because we see their patterns.
So we judge others as predictable machines, but we view ourselves as free agents just because we can't see our own strengths.
Precisely. And here is the crucial insight from Hume, perhaps the most famous thing he ever said. Reason does not guide the will. We like to think we use logic to make choices. Hume says, absolutely not. Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions.
The slave of the passions. That is a heavy statement.
It reverses the whole history of philosophy. Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, they all thought reason should drive the bus and emotion should sit in the back. Hume says, no, emotion is driving. Reason is just the guy holding the map, figuring out how to get where emotion wants to go.
So if I want a donut, my reason isn't telling me whether I should want a donut. It's just calculating the fastest route to the bakery.
Exactly. Reason is just the tool we use to get what our emotions want. Reason cannot tell you what to want. It can only tell you how to get it.
Okay. So I'm a creature of habit, driven by emotion, with no logical proof of the future. This is getting existential. Let's make it worse. Who am I?
The problem of the self.
Yeah, if I don't control my will and my beliefs are just habits, is there a me inside here?
Hume says, look inside. Do some introspection right now. When you look into your own mind, what do you find? Do you find a soul? Do you find a shiny, solid self?
I find thoughts. I find a feeling of being a bit cold. I hear the hum of the computer. I'm thinking about what to say next.
Right. You find a pain, a pleasure, a color, a sound. You find specific perceptions. But do you ever find the container? Do you find the I that is having the perceptions?
No. I just find the perceptions themselves.
This is the bundle theory. Hume describes the mind as a theater stage where perceptions appear and disappear. But here is the kicker. There is no audience. And there is no one behind the curtain. The play is going on, but the theater is empty. We are just a bundle of perceptions.
That is terrifying. And if there's no self-behind the curtain, that makes immortality a pretty tough sell.
It makes it logically impossible to prove. The traditional argument was that the soul is a substance, and substances can be immortal. Hume says, we have no idea what a substance is. We've never seen one. So that argument is out.
He goes through the other arguments too, right? The moral argument, the physical argument.
He dismisses them all. He says, nature shows us that everything perishes. The body rocks, the mind fades with age. Nothing is eternal in our experience. So logically, we should expect the mind to perish too.
But with Hume, we do believe in immortality. Or at least many people do. Why?
Psychology again. Survival. Nature inspires an aversion towards death in us. We are terrified of it so the species can survive. That fear, that forceful impression, creates the belief in immortality. It's a survival mechanism, not a logical truth.
And I have to mention the sarcasm Dr. Holmes put it out.
Yeah.
Hume writes that immortality is brought to light by the gospel alone.
Yes, the gospel alone. Most scholars think he is being very tongue-in-cheek there. He's basically saying, logic can't get you there, so you better hope revelation is true, because that's all you've got.
Which brings us to the next logical target. If we can't prove the self, can we prove the divine? Let's talk about miracles.
This is one of Hume's most famous arguments, and it caused him a lot of trouble in his day.
First, we need a definition. What is a miracle to Hume?
He defines it as a violation of natural law. But remember, for Hume, natural law just means uniformity. It means things happening the same way over and over.
So a miracle is a break in the pattern.
Correct. Now, Hume doesn't say miracles are impossible, logicalized for anything. The sun could turn into a taco tomorrow. Logic doesn't care.
Taco sun.
But Hume says miracles are unbelievable.
Because of the scale.
Exactly. Belief is based on habit. It's based on repetition. You have millions of examples of people dying and staying dead. You have uniform experience of gravity pulling things down. Mm-hmm. Now, suppose someone tells you a story about a man rising from the dead or a person floating in the air. You have their testimony on one side, and you have the entire weight of your life's uniform experience on the other.
And the habit of the uniformity wins.
Always. Hume says the weight of your uniform experience will always outweigh the testimony of a witness. He has that great line, it would take a miracle to create belief in miracles.
He's saying the testimony itself would have to be so overwhelming that the testimony being false would be more miraculous than the event it's describing.
Exactly. It sets the bar impossibly high.
But Dr. Holmes brought up a really funny counterargument from history. The Napoleon satire. This was great.
Oh, this is delightful. So in 1819, a guy named Richard Whately wrote a satire called Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte.
Using Hume's own logic against him.
Yes. He argued that Napoleon's exploits were so unique, so unprecedented, so unlike the uniformity of history, conquering Europe, coming back from exile, these massive battles, that by Hume's logic, we should consider them miracles.
And since miracles are unbelievable,
and Napoleon must not exist. The stories about him must be fictions.
That is brilliant. He's proving that if you're too strict with this uniformity rule, you end up denying real history just because it's extraordinary.
It highlights a potential flaw in Hume's strict empiricism. Sometimes the unique does happen. Black swans exist.
Okay, we've dismantled the self. We've dismantled miracles. Let's go for the big one. God.
Hume attacks this in his dialogues concerning natural religion. It's a conversation between three characters. Cleanthes, who tries to prove God exists through design. Demia, the mystic who says God is unknowable. And Philo, the skeptic, who is basically Hume himself.
And Philo destroys the idea of proving God through analogy. This is the watchmaker argument, right? The world is like a watch, so there must be a watchmaker.
Right. Cleanthes says the world is like a machine, so God is like a mechanic. Philo steps in and says, is the world like a machine? I don't know. It's also organic. It has life. Maybe the world is like a vegetable.
The cosmic cabbage.
The cosmic cabbage. Philo asks, if the universe is more like a vegetable than a machine, does that mean God is a giant farmer? Or maybe the root system?
It sounds ridiculous.
That's the point. Philo's point is that if you use weak analogies, you end up with absurdities. You can't just pick the analogy that suits your theology. If you look at the universe, it's messy. It has chaos. So if there is a designer, maybe he's a distinctively average designer. Or maybe it was a committee of designers.
Or an infant deity who built this world as a bad practice run and then abandoned it.
Exactly. Logic can't get you to the all-knowing, all-good God of Christianity. Logic just gets you to some vague cause.
Dr. Holmes also mentioned Hume's Natural History of Religion. This is where he explains where the idea of God actually comes from if it's not logic.
He argues it's an evolution. It starts with polytheism. Primitive man looks around, sees storms, sees the sun, sees disease. He fears these things, so he invents invisible agents, gods, to explain them.
It's emotional. It's fear.
It's entirely fear and hope. Then, out of a need to flatter these gods, we keep promoting them. My God is stronger than yours. My God is the best. Eventually, you flatter your God all the way up to infinity. You get monotheism.
So monotheism isn't the discovery of truth, it's just the ultimate flattery.
According to Hume, yes, it's born of fear and emotion, not logical deduction. We're just reporting his views here, of course, but that's his stance.
And ultimately, Hume seems to land on what Dr. Holmes calls practical atheism.
Yes. Even if you believe in a first cause or some abstract God, Hume argues it makes no real difference. Belief in an abstract concept doesn't change human morality. Our behavior is driven by our passions and habits, not by a distant theological idea.
So where does this leave us? We started by asking how we know the sun will rise. We found out we don't. We found out ourself is a bundle of perceptions, our choices are driven by passion, and our beliefs are just strong feelings.
It sounds bleak. It sounds like we should just curl up in a ball.
But we don't, and Hume doesn't want us to.
No. Hume calls his final stance mitigated skepticism.
Which means...
It means we don't go to the extreme. We don't become Pyrrhonists, those ancient skeptics who wouldn't walk out the door because they weren't sure the ground was there.
Right. Absolute skepticism is deadly. You'd starve to death because you can't logically prove bread will feed you.
Exactly. We admit we can't know for sure, but we surrender to custom. We surrender to habit. We accept that nature has hardwired us to believe things so that we can survive.
So we act as if we know, even though we know we don't know.
That is the only way to live. Custom is the great guide of human life. We indulge our natural instincts to believe, but we keep our reason modest. We don't go burning people at the stake for dogmas we can't prove.
It's actually kind of freeing. You don't need absolute certainty to act. You just need those forceful impressions.
It humbles the intellect, certainly. It reminds us that we are part of nature, not masters of it.
So here's a final thought for you to carry around today. If all our scientific laws, our personal identities, and our deepest beliefs are essentially just psychological habits reinforced by repetition.
Here it comes.
How many fictions are you currently treating as hard facts just because they feel vivacious to you, just because the impression is strong?
That is a dangerous question to ask yourself before bed.
Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll see you next time.